sharp blade to part silk. Then I was finished. "Only 7? I asked him. I lifted my eyes to watch him as I let my hands check each garment and boot again. I set my plunder out in a short row on the floor before me. Let's see. 2 poisons to mix with liquid, 1 toxic dust, a sleeping powder, and an emetic. So much for the hidden pockets. A tiny shoe knife, scarcely worthy of the name. A set of lockpicks and a block of soft wax. For what? Ah, impressions of keys. Of course. Now, what's this?
That is what I was to leave in her crib.
His voice was stiff, thickened with tears.
For you to find, as a proof that I'd been here.
Ice encased my heart. I gestured at the assassin with my knife, ordering him farther away from the cradle. I moved with him, keeping the same distance. Whatever was in the packet, I would not chance opening it near B. I brought it to a small table touched by firelight. It was a little packet of good paper. I sliced the side carefully with my blade, then tipped it. A very fine chain slid out of it first. I tapped it, and the rest emerged. A very pretty necklace, and expensive, I'd hazard. I held up the chain. Firelight glinted red from it. It's the Farseer Buck, in silver. But he has his head lowered to charge. Interesting. I watched the boy's face as it dangled from my hand. Did he know what it was? The sigil of Fitzchivalry Farseer, the long-dead bastard of the royal family. He didn't.
It's a gift for her, from Lord Shade Falstar.
Of course it is. My voice was flat. I returned to his garments, hooked my toe under the heap, and kicked them to him. You can get dressed.
And my things?
The youngster asked sullenly. He spoke over his shoulder as he tugged on his underthings. I stooped to the floor, and the tools of his trade disappeared up my sleeve. I heard the rustle of fabric as he pulled on his shirt and trousers. What things? I asked pleasantly. Your boots and stockings? There, on the floor. Put them on. Then get out of this room. And stay out of this wing of my home. Or I'll kill you.
I wasn't sent to do the baby harm, only to see it, to leave the gift, and to report back what I'd seen. Lord Shade warned her that you'd catch me, but Lady Rosemary insisted. It was a test. One I failed.
Failed twice, I assume. I doubt they gave you permission to name their names to anyone. The boy was quiet.
They said it was just a test.
His voice broke on the words.
And I failed it. Twice.
You're assuming that you were the only one they were testing. Dressed? Good. Get out. No. Wait. What's your name? He held his tongue. I sighed and took a step toward him.
Lant.
I waited. The boy took a breath that was half a sob.
Fitzvigilant.
I pondered a moment, sifting names of minor nobility. Of Pharaoh?
Yes, sir.
And how old are you? The boy drew himself up straighter.
12, sir.
12? 11, I might have believed. But 10 is more likely, isn't it? The lad's dark eyes flashed fury. The tears were running freely down his cheeks. Oh, Shade, is this your future assassin? He looked down and said simply,
Sir.
I sighed. Had I ever been that young? Go, boy. Now. The spy fled with no pretense at stealth. He did not quite slam the door behind him, but he shut it quite firmly. I listened to the sound of his pattering steps as he fled. When they became softer, I stepped to the door, listened, opened it, and stepped out. Then I closed the door again, retrieved my boots, and came to B's cradle. For now, he's gone, I told my child and shook my head. Shade, you old spider, what are you playing at? Was that truly the best you could send my way? Or was he the decoy? I moved efficiently about the room, checking the window latch and looking everywhere an assassin might conceivably hide. When I had made that round, I returned to the cradle and lifted the lacy drapery away. I found a lamp, lit it, and moved it to the stand by the cradle. I worked as if my staring baby were made of spun sugar as I lifted each blanket away and carefully shook it. Her garments looked untouched. Would I chance that? I had begun removing her clothing to check for anything that this spy or a previous one might have been able to put on her when Molly entered the room.
There you are. I've half a dozen serving boys scouring withywoods for you. Our guests are waiting to go in for a meal. You've missed their minstrel singing a very long song to thank us for our welcome.
Glad of that, I admitted. The tiny ribbons on Bee's gown were defying me.
Fitz?
Molly swept into the room.
What are you doing? Didn't you hear me? The meal is nearly ready.
I lied to her. Again. I came in to be sure she was fine and she was crying. I thought she might be wet.
Crying, and I didn't hear her.
It wasn't loud. I wouldn't have heard her except that I was passing the door. Molly immediately took charge of her. I clenched my teeth, fearing that there might still be something hidden in her garments that could hurt either her or her mother. Molly expertly opened her clothes, checked her napkin, and then looked at me in consternation.
She's fine.
I watched intently as Molly refastened the ribbon ties I had loosened. I don't want to leave her here alone, I said abruptly. Molly stared at me. Then she shook her head.
Nor I,
she admitted.
But I didn't want to take her with us to greet our guests. I want to choose when and how Queen Ketrickan first sees her.
Lady Ketrickan, I reminded her. Queen of the Six Duchies no more.
Only in name,
my wife harumphed.
The Narcheska is in Buckkeep Castle only a few months of every year, and King Dutiful spends too much time away from the throne. She rules the Six Duchies, Fitz, and the Mountain Kingdom.
Well, someone must hold the reins of power when King Dutiful is not there. Better Ketrickan than Shade Unchecked, I replied. Could she hear the divided loyalties in my voice? Hear my unspoken thought that if Ketrickan had not assumed those duties, they might have fallen on me? Certainly Shade had hoped to harness me for that role, and Ketrickan and King Dutiful would have been happy to allow it. I had known Ketrickan since I was a youth, and once we had been as close as only conspirators could be. But tonight, she had brought a spy into my house, one that had come in stealth to my daughter's cradle. Did she know of young Fitz Vigilant's mission? Or had Shade and Lady Rosemary acted alone, out of concern for the Farseer throne and lineage? Well did I know that to Shade, the best interests of the throne came far ahead of the best interests of any individual Farseer. That I had learned at the old assassin's knee. Molly broke into my thoughts.
Nettle will be leading our guests into the dining room soon. We have to be there.
I made a decision. Let's take her with us, cradle and all.
Fitz, I don't think...
But I had already stooped and lifted the cradle. It was not large, but neither was it light. I tried to make it look easy as I edged out the door with it and started down the hall. Behind me, Molly followed with Bee clasped to her breast. The dining hall was not often used. The ceilings were high, and the two hearths at either end of the room struggled to warm such a large space. Molly and I had formed the habit of taking most of our meals in a much smaller room, but tonight the fires had been set and the chandeliers lit. The long table, prepared for 15, could easily have seated 40. The dark wooden table had an embroidered runner down the centre, and silver candelabra holding graceful white tapers, the work of Molly's own hands. Carved wooden bowls in the shape of Eda's cupped hands held red and yellow apples, fat grapes in bunches, and gleaming brown nuts. The candles cast a warm glow over the table, but their light could not reach the distant ceiling or the far corners of the room. We arrived simultaneously with the guests. Molly and I stood and greeted them as they filed past. I put more effort into making holding the cradle look effortless, and was grateful finally to follow them into the room. I made no comment as I set the cradle where the hearth would warm it, but it would not be more than 6 paces from my chair. Molly swiftly settled Bea inside it, and then draped the lace hanger above her that would keep away draughts and casual glances. We moved to the head of the table, once more acknowledged our guests, and took our places. Lady Ketrickon was to my right. Nettle occupied the other seat of honour at Molly's left hand. If any thought the seating arrangement odd, no one spoke of it. I located the young spy seated on the left side of the table and as far from me as possible. He had changed his garments, which was not surprising, as I had not been excessively careful when I was slitting open seams and pockets. He appeared fascinated by the edge of the table. The captain of Ketrickon's guard had accompanied her on this visit, and he was seated with us, attired in his purple and white. She had brought a healer with her, one of noble blood, Lady Solace, and her husband, Lord Diggory. Ketrickon's other followers were unknown to me, except by name. Lord Stoutheart was a bluff and hearty man, white-haired and red-nosed. Lady Hope was plump and pleasant, a chatty woman who laughed frequently. Ketrickon lifted her hand and set it on mine. I turned to her with a smile, and as always I knew that brief moment of surprise. To me, she was always a young woman, golden-haired and blue-eyed, with an open mien and a tranquil air about her. I saw a woman with silver hair, her brow lined with care. Her eyes were as blue as bees. Her spine was straight, her head upright. She was like a graceful glass vessel that brimmed with power and certainty. She was no longer the foreign mountain princess, struggling to negotiate the currents of power at a strange court. She had become the current of power that others must navigate. She spoke for Molly and me alone.
"I am so glad for you."
I nodded and gestured to Revel to begin serving. I made no comment on Bea or how we had brought her into the dining room. Ketrickon understood and did not broach the topic. The meal commenced. It was served with considerably less formality than a dinner at Buckkeep Castle, yet more pomp than we usually observed at Withywood's. Nettle had instructed Revel to keep the visit simple, and though he had chafed at this, he had almost complied. So dishes were passed, and I served the wine, and the conversation was casual and sometimes merry. We learned that Lady Solace often travelled with Ketrickon now, for the old queen had begun to have problems with her joints. At the end of the day, she welcomed her handmaid's oil rubs, as well as the hot drink she concocted. Lord Stoutheart and Lady Hope had joined them simply because they were bound for their own homes for the winter, after a pleasant visit at Buckkeep Castle. Withywood's was on the route that they must travel. Indeed, the bulk of the servants and guards accompanying Ketrickon were not her own people, but Lord Stoutheart's. The smells of the food and the pleasant clatter of eating might have lulled another man. I took this time as my opportunity to study my guests. I considered Lady Solace's presence as genuinely the product of Ketrickon's wish, but reserved judgment on Lord Stoutheart and Lady Hope. I wondered if the youthful assassin had come as part of Ketrickon's retinue. If he had, did Ketrickon know the full of what he was, or had the royal assassins added him as an anonymous member of her party? Perhaps he had been slipped in by Lady Rosemary as a stable boy for the travelling party. I had often served in that capacity when Shade wanted eyes or ears somewhere he himself could not go. Yet the lad had been well dressed, not in a stable hand's leathers, but in silk and linen. I watched Lant as he picked at his food, and wondered again if he was a lure to distract me. I was glad we had not left Bea alone in the room, and decided I would inspect the entire nursery before I put her to bed there tonight. No, I abruptly decided. I would put the cradle by my bed and watch over Bea myself. The relief I felt at that decision was palpable. I found my tongue and became more talkative and jocular, and Molly, Nettle, and Ketrickon all smiled to see me so. The conversation was lively, ranging from the late apple crop to the hunting prospects near Withywood's and Buckkeep Castle to news of old friends who lived in the mountain kingdom. Ketrickan asked after Molly's children and relayed the latest news from the princes. The minstrel and his two assistants arrived with their small drums and pipes and added music to our enjoyment. The meal lasted long, and the hour was late when the last dish was finally cleared from the table.
"Shall we move to a cozier room?" Molly suggested, for the large dining hall was inevitably draughty and cool on a stormy night.
"Let's," I agreed, and Ketrickan replied,
"A warmer room will be a pleasanter place for me to meet your little daughter."
She did not ask. She assumed. I smiled at that. We were old partners at this sort of gaming. She had recognized my gambit, respected it, and now advanced her own. Nonetheless, I resolved that I would win this round against her for B, as I had not won for Nettle. As Molly and I and our guests rose, I smiled, but did not verbally respond to Ketrickan's words. I reached the cradle quickly and held the gauzy drapery aside to allow Molly to gather B up. She draped a blanket around the baby as she did so, and then waited confidently for me to once more lift the cradle. I managed it without a groan. A quick glance told me that Nettle had detained the former queen with some minor conversation, and that she then motioned for her to precede her out of the room. Molly and I came last, following our guests as Nettle led the way to a sitting room. A stranger might have assumed this room was my den. In addition to comfortable seating and a roaring fire in the hearth, the walls were lined with shelves and held many books bound in the Jarmalian style. Above them, on racks, were older scrolls and vellums. There was a desk in the corner near the heavily draped window, and on it was an inkpot and blank paper. It was all for show. On these shelves, a spy might find a journal of the birds I had seen in the last 4 years, or notes on the operation of Withywoods. There were enough estate records and papers in this room to make at least a casual thief believe he had found my lair. But he would find no sign here of Fitzchivalry Farseer, or of the work I did for Shade. Once again the cradle was carefully placed, but as Molly moved to install B in it, Ketrickan swept past Nettle to her side.
"May I hold her?" she asked,
and there was such simple warmth in her request that no one could have refused it. Perhaps only I saw how Molly's smile stiffened as she offered our bundled child to the former queen. As she took B into her arms, blanket and all, Ketrickan's brows lifted in subtle surprise. Nettle moved closer. I felt my older daughter's skill thrumming wariness. I think it was a pack instinct, to protect the smallest that operated on a level so profoundly deep she was scarcely aware of how she joined her skill to mine. The moment could not be avoided. Molly lifted the light covering that had hidden our baby's face. I watched Ketrickan's expression as she looked down into B's answering stare. For the baby was silent but awake, meeting her gaze with eyes as blue as her own. Ketrickan gave so tiny a gasp that perhaps no one else remarked it. Her smile did not fade, but it grew stiffer. She took 2 steps to a chair and sank into it. Then, as if determined to prove something to herself, she loosened the blanket that wrapped B. My daughter was dressed in a confection of silk and lace, such as none of Molly's other children had ever worn. Even taken in to fit our tiny babe, for Molly had sewn it months before the birth, it only emphasized how tiny she was. B's hands were curled onto her chest, and Ketrickan stared at the fingers, as small as a bird's toes. As if daring herself, she touched B's left hand with her forefinger. The other guests had drawn closer, expecting that they, too, would be allowed to see her. Ketrickan glanced up, not at me, but at Lady Solace, her healer. The woman had moved to the old queen's shoulder to look at the child, and now, as her gaze met Ketrickan's, I knew what her resigned countenance conveyed. I had seen it in the eyes of our household women. In her healer's opinion, B was not a child who would remain long in this world. Whatever Ketrickan thought of her pale hair and blue eyes, she said nothing of it. The old queen gently folded the blankets around her and covered her face again. The action chilled me, for her fingers were as gentle as if she were shrouding a dead child.
"She's so tiny," she said, as she offered Bee back to her mother.
She offered sympathy. Somehow her words conveyed that she understood why Bee had not been announced to a world where she would stay only briefly. As I watched Molly's arms enfold her, I sensed her relief to have Bee safely back in her embrace. Molly's back was straight as a guardsman's, her eyes calm and her voice level as she added, "But perfect." "And she's growing every day," I lied heartily. Silence followed my words, and I wished I could call them back. Every woman worked out their import in her own mind, but only the healer spoke.
"How tiny was she when she was born? Did she come early?"
The room stilled, awaiting a response. But Molly only gathered Bee to her and walked over to stand by the fireplace. She rocked and patted her as she stood silently, and as if rebuked, the guests receded to take chairs. Even Ketrickan found a comfortable seat. Only Lady Solace remained standing. She studied Molly and suddenly observed,
"You seem to have recovered very swiftly from your confinement, Lady Molly."
An unspoken question. "Is the baby truly yours?"
"I had an easy time of it,"
Molly replied modestly and glanced aside from the men present in the room. I could feel how avid Lady Solace was to ask more questions. She had the healer's drive to know every root of a problem and then apply her skills to solving it. Molly sensed that too, and it made her uneasy. When she looked at our child, she saw nothing amiss, save that Bee was much smaller than all her other babies had been. But in the healer's inquisitive glance, Molly read that the woman saw Bee as damaged or sickly. Were she given over into that woman's care, she would attempt to fix our babe as if Bee were a broken toy. I felt a rush of antipathy toward the woman. How dare she see my Bee as less than perfect? And beneath that, a cold river of trepidation that she might, somehow, be right. The urge to get her safely away from the healer's anxious eyes raced through me. I did not wish to hear anything the woman might say about Bee. My glance met Molly's. She held our baby closer and then smiled.
"You are so kind to be concerned for me. It is so thoughtful of you, for of course I do tire easily. It is not easy to be a new mother at my age."
Molly smiled round at her guests.
"Thank you kindly for understanding that my daughter will take up my duties as hostess, for I know you will understand my need to retire early. But please, do not feel you must emulate me. I know that my husband has longed for company and seldom gets a chance to spend hours in conversation with old friends. I shall trouble him only to move Bee's cradle for me, and then I shall send him right back to you."
I hoped I covered my surprise. It was not just that she had made such a sudden decision, but the imperious way in which Molly informed all gathered that she had done so. I had a glimpse of Nettle's face. She was already calculating how to repair the social damage. In the set of her mouth I saw two things. She shared her mother's fear that Lady Solace might find something wrong with Bee, and shared her cold tide of certainty that the healer would be right. But I had a cradle to lift, again, and a long flight of stairs before me. I stitched a smile to my face and took up my load. Our guests treated us to a chorus of swift good nights. Molly preceded me, and I came behind, my pride creaking as much as my back. As soon as the door closed behind us, Molly whispered,
"She sleeps in our room tonight, by my bedside."
My thoughts exactly.
"I don't like how that woman looked at Bee."
"Lady Solace?" Molly was silent, seething now. She knew I wanted to be assured that she had taken no offence at Ketrickan's comment, but she would not give me that. She had been offended by Lady Solace, and as Ketrickan had brought her into our home, she extended her affront to the former queen. She knew it divided my loyalty, but offered me no relief. She walked briskly down the hall, and then up the wide steps to our bedchamber on the next floor. I followed her more slowly, the cradle weighing more with every step. By the time I set it down in our bedchamber, Molly had settled B in the center of our bed, and I knew she would sleep between us. Ah, just as well. I moved swiftly around the room, pretending to close the hangings tighter and build the fire higher, but actually checking alcoves and draperies for intruders. I kept my peace while she freed B of her finery and clothed her in a soft little nightshirt. It dwarfed her. As Molly folded the excess length around her feet, I asked her quietly, "You'll be all right here if I go back down to our guests." "I'm latching the door behind you," she told me. I met her gaze. My mate's stare assured me that our cub would be safe with her. "That would be wise," I agreed. "I'll knock and speak through the door when I come up to bed." "Well, that's reassuring," she said quietly, and then, despite ourselves, we both laughed. "I'm sure I'm being silly to worry so," I lied to her. "I'm sure you're being silly to think I'd believe you," she responded, and followed me through the door. After it closed behind me, I heard Molly struggle a moment with a stiff, seldom-used bolt. Then I heard it slide home, metal against metal. It was a good sound. Ketrigan and her companion stayed only a night. We did not bring B in to breakfast the next morning, and no one asked to see her. The minstrel was never summoned to look on her, in public or in private. Ketrigan never mentioned that B should be documented as the true child of Fitzchivalry Farseer. She was never entered into the formal lineage of possible heirs to the throne. Her life would not be like her sister's. That was clear enough. Ketrigan had evaluated my child and found her wanting. I could not decide if I felt angered by her dismissal of B, or deeply grateful. For there was another side to that coin. If Ketrigan had acknowledged my child, even privately, it would have been a veil of protection around her. That she had not claimed to be as part of the Farseer dynasty put her outside the circle and left her as I had been left for so many years, a Farseer who was both an asset and a liability to the throne. Ketrigan announced that she must leave shortly after noon, and that her friends were also travelling on to their home. The looks she gave me were deeply sympathetic. I think she assumed Molly and I wished to be left in privacy, with our dwindling baby, to have what time we could with her before she was gone. It would have been a kind gesture if B were truly failing. As it was hard to bid her a fond farewell, for her departure almost seemed as if she were wishing a swift death on my daughter. Nettle stayed on for a week. She saw B daily, and I think she slowly realized that although B was not thriving and growing, neither was she dwindling. She stayed as she was, eating and drinking, her blue eyes taking in everything, her wit spark strong in my awareness. At last, Nettle announced she must return to Buckkeep and her duties there. Before she left, she found a quiet moment to berate me for not telling her sooner of B's birth, and to plead that if there was any change in the health of the child or Molly, I skill to her immediately. I promised her that without difficulty. I did not skill to shade about his failed spy. I needed time to think. B was safe. Jest or test or threat, whatever it was over. I had seen little of young Lant during Ketrigan's stay, but I did stand outside to be sure he was with her when she rode away. In the days that followed, I heard nothing from Shade about him. In the weeks that followed, Molly's sons came and went in ones and twos, some with wife and children, others alone. They inspected B with the fond and accepting equanimity of much older siblings. There she was, another baby, very small, but their mother seemed happy, and Tom Badgerlock seemed content with his lot, so there was nothing for them to fret about here, and a great deal to worry about at their respective homes. The house seemed to grow quieter after the company had left, as if winter had truly settled into the bones of the land. I enjoyed my lady wife and my child, and I pondered my next move. Chapter 8 The Spider's Lair. And so, as I always have, I turn to you for counsel. Fool that you are, you always gave me the wisest advice. Even as I know how impossible it is, I yearn once more to sit down and take thought with you. You always had the mind to look at the tangled knot of court politics and tell me where each thread was wound and trapped, to trace each strand in the hangman's noose back to its instigator. I miss your insight sorely, as much as I miss your companionship. No warrior, you. And yet, with you at my back, I felt guarded as with no other. But I will also admit that you have wounded me as few others could. You wrote to Jofron, but not to me? If there had been but one note from you, in all these years, at least I would have a place to send these useless musings. By messenger or bird, I could send them on their way to you, and imagine that in some distant time or place they reached you, and you spared a thought for me. You know my nature. I take the bits and clues and puzzle them into an image in which you deliberately do not write to me so that I cannot reach out to you in any way. Why? What can I think except that you fear I will somehow undo your work? From that foundation, I must wonder if that was always what I was to you. Only the catalyst? The weapon that must be wielded without mercy and then set aside lest somehow it do an injury to you or your work? I need a friend, and I have none to whom I can admit my weakness, my fear, my errors. I have Molly's love and Bee's need for my strength. I dare not admit to either of them that my heart breaks to see Bee remain a passive infant. As my dreams for her evaporate, and I fear a future in which she remains forever infantile and stunted, to whom can I confide my pain? To Molly, who dotes on her and fiercely insists that time will give her what she lacks? She does not seem to recognize that our child appears less intelligent than a two-day-old chick. Fool, my child will not meet my eyes. When I touch her, she draws away from me as much as she can, which is not far, for she does not roll herself over nor lift her head at all. She makes not a sound save when she wails. Even that is not often. She does not reach for her mother's finger. She is passive, fool, more plant than child, and my heart breaks daily over her. I want to love her. And instead I find I have lost my heart to the child that is not here, the child I imagined she would be. And so I look at my Bee, and long for her to be that which she is not, which perhaps she never shall be. Ah, I do not know what comfort anyone could offer me, save to let me say these things aloud, and not recoil in horror from my heartlessness. Instead, I write these words and consign them to the flames or the litter of other useless musings that nightly I obsessively write. I waited 4 months before I went to Buckkeep Castle to confront Shade and Lady Rosemary. During those days the household was quiet, but busy in the routine way that life was always busy. My baby daughter nursed well and slept as little as any newborn did, according to Molly, which seemed an impossibly small amount to me. Yet she did not disturb our nights with crying. Instead, she lay still and silent, eyes open and staring into the corner of the darkened room. She slept still sheltered between Molly and me, and all hours of the day she was in her mother's care. Bee grew, but so slowly. She remained healthy, but Molly confided to me that she did not do what other babes of her age could do. At first I ignored this worrying. Bee was small, but perfect in my eyes. When I looked down on her in her crib, she stared at the ceiling with a blue gaze that pierced my heart with love.
Give her time, I told Molly. She'll get there. I've fed up many a weakling and seen them become the sharpest hounds in the pack. She'll do. She isn't a puppy, Molly rebuked me, but she smiled and added, she was long in the womb and emerged small. Perhaps it will take her more time to grow outside me as well. I do not think she believed my words, but she took comfort all the same. As the days passed, however, I could not ignore that my baby was not changing. At a month, she was little bigger than when she had been born. At first, the maids would remark on what a good baby she was, so calm and placid. But soon they stopped saying such things, and pity grew in their faces. The fear rose in me that our child was an idiot. She had none of the features of a half-wit child that all parents know. Her tongue fit her mouth. Her eyes and ears were proportional to her little face. She was as pretty as a doll, and as small and unresponsive. I did not face it then. Instead, I focused on the spy that Shade had sent into my home. In quiet, my anger grew. Perhaps I fed it with the fear and dread that I did not admit to myself. I thought long about it. I did not want to confront Shade by way of the skill. I told myself that I needed to stand before him and make him recognize that I was not a man to be toyed with, not when it concerned my child. At the end of 4 months, satisfied that all had remained quiet at home, I invented an excuse to visit Brushbanks. My tale was that I wished to look at a stud horse I'd heard was there. I promised Molly to return as soon as I possibly could, packed warmly for a chilly journey, and chose an unremarkable chestnut mare named Sally from the stable. She was a rangy mount, with an easy gait that ate up the miles and no ambition to challenge her rider. I thought her the perfect mount for my journey to Buckkeep Town. I could have used the standing stones to make the journey, but I would have had to stable the horse somewhere. I told myself I did not wish to invite curiosity, and while my business with Shade was urgent, it was not an emergency, and I could admit to myself that I was afraid to do so. Since I had used the stones to travel to Shade's sickbed, I had felt drawn to repeat the experiment. Had I been younger and less experienced with the skill, I would have put it down to curiosity and a desire for knowledge. But I had felt that yearning before. It was the skill hunger, an urge to use the magic simply for the sake of feeling it thrill through me. No, I would not risk a skill pillar journey again, especially since I suspected Shade now monitored them and would be aware of my coming. I intended to surprise the old spider, let him recall how it felt to discover that someone had penetrated his defences. I rode from early morning to late at night, eating dried meat or oat cakes as I rode, and sleeping well off the side of the road. I had not travelled so rough in years, and my aching back each morning reminded me that even when I was a young man, it had been uncomfortable. Nonetheless, I did not stop at any inns, nor pause in any of the small towns I passed. A day away from Withywoods, I had donned the humbler garb of a tradesman. I did all I could to keep anyone from remarking on the passage of a lone traveller, let alone recognizing me as Tom Badgerlock. I timed my journey so that I arrived at Buckkeep late in the evening. I found a tidy little inn among the outskirts of Buckkeep town and bought myself a room for the night and stabling for my horse. I ate a fine meal of roast pork, stewed dried apples, and dark bread, and went up to my room. When night was full and dark, I left the inn quietly and took a long walk up to Buckkeep Castle. I did not go to any of the gates, but to a very secret entrance that I had discovered as Shade's apprentice. What had been a fault in the wall had been repaired to allow a covert route in and out of the keep. The masking thorn bushes around it were as thick as ever, and both my skin and my jerkin were torn before I reached the actual stone of the wall and squeezed through the deceptively narrow gap there, gaining entrance to Buckkeep.
but penetrating the outer wall was just the first step. I was inside the walls of the keep, but not in the castle itself. This section of the keep's grounds was reserved for protecting stock should we ever be besieged. During the Red Ship War, some animals had always been kept here, but I doubted it had seen much use in recent times. In the darkness, behind some empty sheep pens, I shed my homespun blouse and loose trousers and concealed the garments in an unused wooden trough. Beneath them, I was dressed in Buckkeep blue, in my old blue Buck Guardsman's uniform. It was a bit snugger around the middle than I recalled it being, and smelled of fleabane and cedar from the chest where I had stored it, but I trusted it would get me past any casual glance. Head down, and walking slowly as if I were weary or perhaps a bit drunk, I wandered across the yards and in through the kitchen door that led to the guardsman's dining area. I felt a strange mixture of emotions at this secretive homecoming. Buckkeep Castle would always be home to me, and the kitchens especially so. So many boyhood memories surged back on the wave of aromas that welcomed me. Ale and smoked meats and fat cheeses, bread baking and hot soup bubbling and beckoning. I nearly yielded to the temptation to go in and sit down and eat. Not for hunger's sake, but just to taste again the flavors of home. Instead, I wandered down the stone-flagged corridor, past two storage rooms. Just short of the steps to the cellar, I entered a certain pantry. There, I let my self-discipline slip and helped myself to a short rope of linked sausage before triggering the panel of shelves that accessed the castle's spyways. I pulled it closed behind me and stood for a moment in the utter darkness of those passages. I ate a link of the sausage and idly wished there had been time for a tankard of Buckkeep ale to go with it. Then with a sigh, I let my feet lead the way through the twisting corridors and narrow stairs that threaded the interior walls of Buckkeep Castle. This was a labyrinth I had known since my childhood. The only surprises I encountered were the few spiderwebs that were a familiar hazard of this maze. I did not go to the secret chambers where Shade had first taught me the assassin's trade. I knew he no longer lived and slept in that space as he once had. Instead, I wormed my way through the narrow passage behind the walls on the same level as the king's bedchamber. I swiftly gained access to Shade's grand bedchamber via a mirrored panel in his water closet and was a bit surprised that he had not blocked it in some way. I crept silently in, dreading that he would be waiting for me, having somehow divined my plan. But his room was empty and chill, the fire banked low on the hearth. Moving swiftly, I took a gleaming brown acorn from my pocket and left it in the center of his pillow. Then I retreated once more to the spy labyrinth and sought his old murder laboratory. Ah, but how it had changed since my childhood. The floors were swept and mopped clean of dirt and dust. The scarred stone table where we had conducted our experiments when I was a boy was immaculately clear of ingredients and apparatus. All was neatly stowed on shelves. The bowls and glassware had been cleaned and sorted by category. There was a specific place for each mortar and pestle, and for each spoon of wood and iron and brass. There were far fewer scroll racks than I recalled, and the ones that were there were neatly stocked. Another rack held the tools of my erstwhile trade. Small knives with grooved blades, some sheathed and some bare, rested beside neatly packaged and labelled powders and pellets, some soporific and some toxic. Gleaming needles of silver and brass were safely thrust through strips of soft leather. Coiled garrots slumbered like deadly little snakes. Someone with a very methodical mind was in charge of this now. Not Shade. Brilliant and precise as the man was, he had never been tidy. Nor did I see signs of his ongoing scholarship. No tattered old manuscripts awaited translation or recopying. There were no scatters of spoiled pens, no open containers of ink. A sumptuous featherbed covered the old wooden bedstead, and the small fire in the neatly swept hearth burned cleanly. The bed looked as if it was for show rather than something that was regularly used. I wondered who tended these chambers now. Certainly not Thick. The simple little man was old for one of his kind, and he had never cared for his housekeeping tasks. He would not have supplied a rack of wax tapers, standing tall and straight as ranked soldiers, ready to take their places in the candle holders. I lit two to replace the ones that had almost gutted out in the brass holders on the table. I deduced this was Lady Rosemary's domain now. I settled in her cushioned chair by the hearth after adding two logs to the fire. Little sweet biscuits in a covered bowl and a decanter of wine were on a small table close at hand. I helped myself and then kicked out my feet toward her fire and leaned back. I didn't care which of them found me here. I had words for both of them. My gaze wandered over the mantel, and I almost smiled to see that King Shrewd's fruit knife was still embedded in the center of it. I wondered if Lady Rosemary knew the tale of how it had come to be there. I wondered if Shade recalled how coldly angry I had been when I drove the blade into the wood. The anger that burned in me now was colder and far more controlled. I'd have my say, and when I had finished, we would come to terms. My terms. Shade had always been a night owl. I was resigned to a long wait before he would find my message on his pillow. The watch passed, and I dozed in the chair lightly. But when I heard the light scuff of slippers on the steps, I knew it was not his stride. I lifted my head and turned my gaze to the concealed stairway. A heavy tapestry draped it to keep out the draught from the maze. I was only mildly surprised when it lifted to reveal the countenance of young Fitzvigilant. He was dressed far more simply than the last time I had seen him, in a simple white shirt, blue vest, and black trousers. His soft low shoes whispered his approach. The large silver earrings in his ear had been replaced by two much smaller ones of gold. His tousled hair hinted that perhaps he had risen from his bed to perform his duties here. I watched him startle at the sight of the freshly lit tapers. I was very still, and it took a moment for his eyes to pick me out. Then he gaped at the sight of a humble guardsman in such a special and secret place before he recognized me.
"You!"
he gasped and took a step back. "Me," I affirmed. "Well, I see they kept you on. But you've still much to learn of caution, I think." He stared at me wordlessly. "I suspect that Lady Rosemary or Lord Shade will soon be arriving for a late-night lesson with you. Am I correct?" He opened his mouth to speak, then clapped it shut. So, perhaps he had learned a bit of caution since last we had met. He essayed a sideways shift toward the weapons rack. I smiled and cautioned him with a wag of my finger. Then a flip of my wrist, and a knife sprang into my hand. Some tricks one never forgets. He gaped at it and lifted wide eyes to stare at me. It was very gratifying. I suddenly wondered if I had ever looked at Shade with such puppyish awe. I made a decision. "Neither one of us needs to be armed," I told him pleasantly. I bent my hand and the knife was gone. It was enough that he knew how quickly it could reappear. I leaned back in my chair and appeared to relax, and saw his shoulders lower in response. I sighed to myself. The lad had so much to learn. For now, however, his naivety served my purpose well. I looked at him for a moment, reading as much as I could of him without making my gaze into a stare. He'd have his guard up against direct questions, but he was already beginning to be uncomfortable with my silence. I sighed, letting my body appear to relax even more as I reached for the wine again. I poured another glass. He shifted his feet uncomfortably.
"That's Lady Rosemary's favorite wine," he objected mildly.
"Is it? Well, she has good taste then. And I know she wouldn't mind sharing some with me. We've known each other a long time. She was just a child when I first met her." That piqued his interest. I wondered how much he had been told of me when they'd sent him on his mission to Bee's Cradle. Not too much, I judged. Shade valued caution as a virtue surpassing almost all others. I smiled at him. He took my bait.
Is that who showed you how to get here? Lady Rosemary?
Furrows appeared in his brow as he tried to piece it together and see where I belonged.
Who are you talking to, Lant?
Lady Rosemary's voice reached us before she had entered the room. The lad spun toward her. I remained where I was, wineglass in hand.
Oh!
She halted, holding the curtain aside and looked at me. I had told the apprentice the truth. I had known her when she was a child, though we'd had little to do with each other since then. Prince Regal had recruited her when she was a chubby little maid, even younger than Fitzvigilant. Regal had arranged a position for her, serving the mountain-born princess who had wedded King-in-Waiting Verity. She had been Regal's little spy on his brother's wife, and quite likely had been the one who greased the tower steps and caused the pregnant Ketrican to take a bad fall. That had never been proven. When Regal had tumbled from power, all of his minions had descended into disgrace as well, the child Rosemary among them. Only Ketrican's forgiving nature had saved her. When all else shunned her, Ketrican had seen her as a confused child, torn between loyalties and quite possibly guilty only of trying to please the man who had been so kind to her mother. Queen Ketrican had taken her back into her court and seen to her education, and Shade, never one to waste anything, had seen her as a partially trained tool for spying and assassination, and quickly made her his own. Now she stood before me, a woman in the middle of her life, a lady of the court, and a trained assassin. We regarded each other. She knew me. I wondered if she clearly recalled how she had pretended to drowse on the steps of the Queen-in-Waiting's throne while I reported to Ketrican. Even after all those years, I felt both horror and resentment that a mere child had so easily deceived me. She stepped into the room, lowered her eyes before my gaze, and then dropped into a deep curtsy.
Lord Fitzchivalry Farseer, you honour us. Welcome.
And as neatly as that, she had foxed me again. I did not know if she tried to convey respect to me, or if she was conveying information to her apprentice as quickly as she could. The boy's swift intake of breath told me that he'd had no idea of my true identity, but that he now guessed the full import of my visit. And perhaps he understood more of his original errand at Withywood's. I looked at her coolly. Has no one ever warned you what you may conjure up when you give welcome and name a ghost?
Welcome? An honour? I'd call it an extreme annoyance, dropping in at this hour unannounced.
Shade pushed into the room from behind the same tapestry that had admitted Rosemary. Lady Rosemary was attired in a simple morning dress, and I suspected that after whatever lesson she'd planned with Fitzvigilant, she had intended to begin her day. In contrast, Shade was nattily attired in a snug-fitting green shirt with voluminous white sleeves. The shirt was belted with black and silver, and the skirts of it fell almost to his knees. His leggings were black, his slippers likewise, but worked with silver beads. His silver-grey hair was bound back in a severe warrior's tail. Obviously, he was at the end of a very long night's entertainment, rather than the beginning of a day's work. He was blunt.
What brings you here?
I met his gaze. That's the same question I asked young Fitzvigilant about 4 months ago. His answer did not satisfy me, so I thought I might come here and get a better one. From you. Shade gave a huff of disdain.
Well, there was a time when you were not so severe when a prank had been played upon you.
He crossed the room, his carriage a bit stiff. I suspected a binding beneath that shirt, helping him look fit and easing his old back. He reached the hearth and looked about distractedly.
Where has my chair gotten to?
Rosemary gave a small sigh of exasperation.
It has been months since you've been up here, and you told me I might arrange things to suit myself.
He scowled.
That doesn't mean that you can arrange things to discomfort me.
She pursed her lips and shook her head, but motioned at Fitch Vigilant.
The old chair is in the corner with the other rubbish that hasn't gone out yet. Fetch it, please.
Rubbish?
Shade repeated indignantly.
What rubbish? I had no rubbish up here.
She crossed her arms on her chest.
Cracked bowls and chipped cups, a small cauldron with a broken bale, flasks of old oil, gone nearly to shellac, and all the rest of the litter you had pushed to the end of the table.
Shade's scowl deepened, but he only grunted in response. Fitzvigilant brought his old chair back to its place by the hearth. Without rising, I slid Rosemary's chair over to make room for it. For the first time in decades, I looked at Shade's seat. The scrolled woodwork was scarred. The joints were loose, and the cushion still showed where I had mended it after Slink the ferret had had a tremendous battle with it one night. I looked around the room.
No ferret?
I asked.
And no ferret droppings,
Rosemary replied acerbically. Shade rolled his eyes at me. With a sigh, he lowered himself into the chair. It creaked under him. He looked at me.
Well, Fitz, how have you been?
I would not allow him to dismiss my mission so lightly.
Annoyed, offended, and wary, ever since I found an assassin creeping about my baby's cradle.
Shade gave a dismissive snort of laughter.
An assassin? Scarcely. He's barely even a spy yet.
Well, that's so comforting, I responded.
Ah, Fitz, where else should I send him to cut his teeth? It's not like when you were a boy and we had a simmering war and a treacherous little pretender to the throne, simpering and plotting at Buckkeep. I had a dozen ways to measure your progress right here within the castle walls. But Fitzvigilant isn't so fortunate. I have to send him farther afield to test him. I try to choose his tasks carefully. I knew you wouldn't hurt him, and I thought it might be a good way to test his mettle.
Not to test me, then. He lifted his hand from his chair's arm and waved it vaguely.
Perhaps a bit. It never hurts to be sure a man hasn't lost his edge.
He looked around.
Is that wine?
Yes. I refilled my glass and offered it to him. He received it, took a sip, and set it down. When he did, I asked, "So, why do I need an edge still?" He stared at me, his green eyes piercing.
You bring another farseer into the world and ask me that?
I kept my temper. No farseer. B. Badgerlock is her name. I bit back that my little girl would never be a danger to anyone. Elbow on the arm of his chair, he rested his chin in his hand.
You have lost your edge, if you think a shield that thin can protect her.
Protect her from what? I glanced past him to where Rosemary and Fitzvigilant were standing. The only danger I have seen has come from people I should be able to trust. People I thought would protect her.
It wasn't danger. It was a reminder that you need to be watchful. From the beginning. By the time you discover there's a danger, it's too late to put your wards in place.
He bristled his eyebrows at me.
Tell me, Fitz, what have you planned for this child? What education? What training? What will you dower her with? And where do you hope she will wed?
I stared at him. She's a baby, Shade, and probably ever would be. Even if she began to grow and show a clever mind, there was plenty of time for me to think of such things. Still, it smote me that I had given no thought to any of that. What would become of her when Molly and I were gone? Especially if she was an idiot. Shade turned in his chair, and the outline of his binding showed briefly beneath his shirt. He glared at our audience.
Haven't you two some lessons to complete?
Yes, but
somewhere else,
he added authoritatively. Rosemary folded her lips for a moment.
Tomorrow, she said to FitzVigilant, and the boy's eyes grew round to be so hastily dismissed.
He sketched a bow to her, then turned to us and halted, plainly confused as to how to bid us farewell. I nodded to him pleasantly.
I hope not to see you again soon, FitzVigilant.
Likewise, sir,
he responded and then froze, wondering if he had been rude. Shade chuckled. The boy whisked himself from the room, and with a final exasperated sigh, Lady Rosemary followed him at a more dignified pace. Shade did not speak, giving them time to be well down the hidden staircase before he turned to me.
Admit it. You've given no thought at all to her future.
I haven't, because I didn't even realize Molly was truly pregnant. But now that Bee is here...
Bee! Such a name! Is she going to live? Does she thrive?
He cut in relentlessly. That gave me pause. She is tiny, Shade, and Molly says that she is not doing the things she should be doing by now. But she eats well, and sleeps, and sometimes cries. Other than how small she is, and that she does not lift her head or roll over yet, I see nothing wrong. My words ran out. Shade was looking at me with sympathy. He spoke kindly.
Fitz, you have to imagine every possible future for her. What will you do if she's simple, or if she can never care for herself? Or what if she grows to be beautiful and intelligent, and people recognize her as a farseer? Or if she is ordinary and plain, and not very bright? At the very least, all will know she is the sister of the king's skill mistress. That is enough power to be courted right there, or to make her a valuable hostage.
He gave me no time to gather my thoughts as he added,
Nettle was educated well enough for a country girl whose prospects were little better than to marry a landed farmer. Talk to her sometime about where she feels that lack. Burrick taught her to read and write and tally. Molly taught her beekeeping and gardening, and she's a good hand around a horse. But history? The shape of the world? Languages? She got little of that, and has spent years trying to mend those gaps. I've met Molly's other children, and they are good enough men. But you are not raising a farmer's daughter, Fitz. If the bones had rolled differently, she might expect to wear the coronet of a farseer princess. She won't, but you should educate her as if she would.
If she could be educated. I pushed the thought away.
Follow Shade's reasoning.
Why?
Because one never knows what fate will bring.
He gestured expansively with one hand as he lifted the wine glass in the other.
If she tests for the skill and has it, would you have her come to Buckkeep Castle with no knowledge of her heritage? Would you have her struggle as Nettle did to learn to navigate the waters of society? Tell me, Fitz, if you raise her as Bee Badgerlock, will you be content to marry her off to a farmer and let her toil all her days?
If she loves him and he loves her, that is not a terrible fate.
Well, if a wealthy nobleman fell in love with her, and she had been raised to be an eligible match for him, and she loved him, that might be a better one, would not you say?
I was still trying to think of a response when Shade added,
FitzVigilant had no prospects. Lord Vigilant's young wife has less than no use for the bastard, and resents that he is older than the legitimate heir she has borne her lord. She is raising his two younger brothers to hate him. Word came to me that she was looking for a quiet death for the boy. Instead of that, I brought him here to make him yet another useful bastard.
He seems bright enough, I said carefully.
Bright, yes, but he has no edge. I'll do what I can with him. But in 7 or 8 years, I'll need to put him somewhere else. Lord Vigilant's wife regards him as a usurper. She already mutters against him being at court. She is the worst sort of jealous woman, one who puts her ill will into action. Better for all if he is gone from Buckkeep when she presents her two sons here.
7 or 8 years from now.
Unlike you, I plan ahead for those I take under my wing.
And you will ask me to take him. I frowned and tried to see his plan. As a possible match for Bea when she's older?
Gods, no! Let's not mingle those bloodlines. We'll find her a lordling from Buck, I think. But yes, I'd like you to be ready to take him in. When he's ready.
Ready to be a killer and a spy?
Why?
Shade shook his head. He seemed oddly disappointed.
No, there's no assassin in him. I'm certain of that. Though Rosemary remains to be convinced. And so I will take his training in a different direction, one useful to both of us. The boy has a bright mind. He learns almost as quickly as you did. And he has a loyal heart. Give him a good master, and he would be true as a hound. And very protective.
Of B. Shade was watching the dying fire. He nodded slowly.
He's quick with languages and has almost the memory of a minstrel. In the guise of a tutor, he could be placed in your household to the benefit of both of them.
The pieces were beginning to fit together. Oh, Shade, why is it so hard for you to ask a direct favor? I put it into words for him. You like the boy, but if you keep him here, sooner or later, when his legitimate younger brothers come to Buckkeep, it will cause problems, especially if he has made friends among the nobility here. Shade nodded.
He's very charismatic. He likes people. He likes to be around them, and they like him. He quickly becomes too visible to be a good spy, and he doesn't have... whatever it is that we have that makes us able to kill.
He drew a breath as if he would say more, and then sighed it out. We were both silent, thinking. I wondered if that ability was something we both had, or if we both lacked something, and thereby could do the sorts of things we had done. The silence was not a comfortable one. Yet it wasn't guilt we shared. I'm not sure a word exists for whatever it was. I'd have to talk to Molly about it. He sent me a quick sideways glance.
You'd tell her... what?
I bit my lip. The truth. That he's a bastard like me. That he will eventually have difficulties because of it. Possibly life-threatening difficulties. That he's well-educated and would be a good tutor for a little girl.
The truth, with holes in it,
Shade amended for me. What holes? I demanded.
Indeed, what holes?
Shade agreed dryly.
And you need not talk to her yet. We have years, I suspect, before I must send him off to you. I'll educate him in all he must know to be a tutor, and a bodyguard. Until he is ready, I know a nursemaid I could send you for the child. Face like a hare, and the arm of a smith. Not the brightest of servants, but formidable as a guard.
No, thank you. I think that, for now, I can protect my daughter.
Oh, Fitz, I don't agree, but I know when it's useless to argue with you. Riddle and I have agreed that you need door soldiers, but you won't listen. How many times have I suggested that you should host one of our skilled journeymen at Withy Woods, so that even in your absence, messages could be swiftly passed? You should have a man of your own, to watch your back and mingle with the servants, and bring you the news that you otherwise would not hear about your holdings.
He shifted in his chair, the old wood creaking under him. His gaze met my stubborn look. I prevailed.
Well, it's late. Or it's early, depending on what part of the day you work in. Either way, I'm off to bed.
Furtively, he tugged at the top edge of the girdle. I suspected it was cutting into him. He pulled himself to his feet. With one hand he made a vague gesture at the bed.
You can sleep here if you wish. I don't think Rosemary ever uses that bed. She just likes to make things pretty when she can.
I may. To my surprise, I realized my anger had vanished. A new shade. It meant no harm to be. Perhaps his whole aim had been to provoke this visit from me. Perhaps he missed me more than I'd realized. And perhaps I should have taken under advisement some of his suggestions. He nodded.
I'll have Fitzvigilant bring some food up for you. Get to know him, Fitz. He's a good lad. Tractable and anxious to please. Not like you were.
I cleared my throat and asked, Are you getting soft-hearted in your old age? He shook his head.
No! Practical. I need to set him aside so Rosemary and I can find a more fitting apprentice. He knows too much of our inner workings for us just to let him go. I have to put him somewhere that will keep him safe.
Keep him safe, or keep you safe? He cracked a smile.
It's the same thing, don't you see? People who are dangerous to me seldom flourish for long.
The smile he gave me was crooked with sadness. I saw his dilemma more clearly as he handed the half-emptied glass to me. I made my suggestion quietly. Start to move him out of your circle, Shade. Less time with you or Rosemary, more time with the scribes and minstrels. You can't make him forget what he has seen and what he knows, but you can lessen its importance. Make him grateful, and when you can no longer keep him here, send him to me. I'll keep him for you. I tried not to realize what I had just agreed to do. This was not a promise that would last a year or two. So long as Fitzvigilant lived and remembered the secret ways of Buckkeep Castle, I would be responsible for seeing that he remained loyal to the Farseers. Loyal or dead. Shade had just handed me a dirty task that he did not want to do. I sipped the wine, covering the bitterness of that knowledge with the too sweet vintage.
Are you certain when you say you can't make him forget?
That jerked my attention back to the old man. What are you thinking? I countered.
That we are still deciphering the old skill scrolls. They hint that you can make a man, well, change his mind about things.
He shocked me into an appalled silence. To be able to make a man forget something. What a horrifying power. I found breath. And that worked so very well when my father decided to make Skillmaster Galen forget his dislike of him and love him. His hate didn't vanish, it just found another target. As I recall, it was me. It nearly managed to kill me.
Your father did not have the benefit of complete instruction in the skill. I doubt that Galen did. So much was lost, Fitz. So much. I work on the scrolls almost every evening, but it's not the same as being instructed by a knowledgeable skill master. Deducing what they mean is laborious. It doesn't go as fast as I wish it would. Nettle has no time to help me. The information they contain is not to be shared with just anyone, and the fragility of the scrolls themselves is another consideration. I myself have far less time for late-night studies than I used to. So the scrolls are neglected, and with them, who knows what secrets?
Another favor couched as a question. Select the ones you consider most interesting. I'll take them back to Withywoods with me. He scowled.
Couldn't you come here to work on them, 1 week out of each month? I'm loath to send them away from Buckkeep Castle.
Shade, I've a wife and a child and a manor to take care of. I can't spend my time gallivanting back and forth to Buckkeep Castle.
The skill pillars would make your gallivant the matter of a few moments.
I won't do it, and you know why.
I know that years ago,